Hello, this is Anahita Hangout, episode 8 on Friday, April 27th, 2012. We are here with Bent and Ash Sanyan. Ash and I are the co-founders and core developers of the open source Anahita social networking platform and framework. Today, we will be answering some questions from Bent and as well as some frequently asked questions about Anahita that are from the Anahita tribes. How's everybody today?
Great. I'm fine.
Good. today, we didn't have many people signing up. Ravi signed up and then I told Ash that let's do it ourselves because I had a list of FAQs prepared from the community, and I said it's a great chance for us to talk about those, and then Bent was available to join in, which is always a pleasure to have him, and now I couldn't get a hold of Ravi. I don't know where he is, even though I invited him, so I hope he joins in during the show. Let's hang out, guys. How are you doing, Bent, and did you have a question that we could start with?
Yes, I have actually prepared a question.
Okay, sounds good.
And, I have also found a topic that I saw. There was another of the members presenting, and I have followed up on it, and my answer I sent just in the chat, so you could follow.
Mm-hmm.
It is, you see, I'm thinking about, I have different groups. I have come to two groups now in setting up Anahita.
Mm-hmm.
And I can see, for example, that Anahita Police, approximately like, I have enrolled in all the groups because I want to follow everything. And of course, you don't have to do that. But for Anahita Police, I think that it's very easy to see the structure like it is. But if we now see that it was many, many different interests, like I maybe have a student community, some sport referees, some professionals in the field, maybe some equipment suppliers, and so on and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, how to, in one community, set up, in one social network, to set up different communities in a visual way, and still have the connections. And I can see that you have addressed this one time before mentioning component module that displays the similar group. I don't know if you can remember that.
I'm not sure. Can you share the link? That's probably one of the answers I posted one time.
Yes, that is so.
It's all right. Maybe you can explain to me right now. That's probably better. So you mentioned about having different communities. By different communities, do you mean different groups in a social network?
So it is just the fact that the sport referees,
okay,
they will probably like to have their own collection of groups.
Oh, okay.
And then other categories of people, they would like to have their own collection of groups. So in one way, they are in one network because they are all interested basically in the same thing,
mm-hmm,
but they are still in different communities. Some are learning communities, some are communities of practice, and so on and so on. So this is my next challenge to how to deal with that.
Well,
and one question, when you say a collection of groups, I still understand, you mean the context of the groups from one collection is different than the other, but who sets that context? How is it different, one collection from another?
It is more that the judges and sport referees will have some dialogue with trainers, but they also will have separate groups and also maybe a separate collection of groups.
I think what Bent has in mind, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, is that, okay, you have one social network that has, let's say, all the students on campus, and then you have some sports-related groups operated by referees or administered by referees, and you have other set collection of groups, let's say, for art programs or music or other things, or science. Am I right or wrong?
Yes, this could be the situation. And I think the one that originally took up the topic, his situation, I think it was to make a network for, I think it was veterans.
Okay.
And his way to do it was that he wanted to think about, you have the Marines or the, and the Air Force as two separate units.
Mm-hmm.
And his topic was something similar. Understand what I mean.
Well, the first way that comes to my mind, because trying to put the groups in categories, that means the admin of the site has to be there, and anytime a new group is created, the site owner has to find a location for it on the tree. So it's not a very scalable approach. It would be better that we take an organic approach. The first, and we don't have the feature right now, but I think once we have Folksonomy created, a group should be able to, we should be able to tag groups. And then we can assign unique hashtags for every department, let's say music, let's say sports or arts. And that way when people search, they find the groups better. So that's how we can make collections of groups using Folksonomy. The other way, we also looked at possibility of making groups that they can follow back. They can also follow other groups. That's an experiment. I know Google Plus is doing it. Or just creating simple associations between amongst actors. So when you join a group, also there could be associations with other groups or events. We have to experiment with those. We haven't built those yet. And these are things we can start working on after the 1.7 release. Ash, you had
something. Well, I was going to say that I see the need. I'm just trying to figure out that, I mean, I get it. You have students, you want to say, you know, these are the groups for, let's say, related to art. These are the groups related to sport. These are the groups.
Yeah.
Well, you can do that with groups. I mean, what makes a group different from another is not the actual group, it's the content of the group. So as long as each group has a context, as long as you can sort of tell people that, listen, this is a group that, for referees, this is a group for art. And I don't know if you have any restriction. Can a student join any group, or can they not join to some of the groups? How does that work?
No, this is the tricky thing, because, for example, to join, for example, the sport referee group, you have to be a qualified sport referee. Because they don't want to have open discussions with everybody.
I think that's the case. That the conversation came up yesterday about ability to send a request to follow a group. So I think that's how you can solve that problem, that I send a request, and if the referee knows me, and they add me to the group.
Yes.
There are so many ways you can actually fix it. It really depends on how... Actually, there's many ways that you can fix, you can solve this problem. It really depends on, if you want to use an existing feature that Anahita offers, if you want to use that, you have to use the groups and get around that somehow. The most extreme approach would be that if somebody is a developer, they can actually build custom groups. It's not very difficult to do, but like you can actually create custom groups that creates custom behavior for each group. For example, a referee group of type of referee, for example, only allows referee in it, and then it can have its own logic in it. So there are many ways to solve this, it really depends on if you want to use an existing feature, as Rustin said, that, well, Anahita groups are generic. It comes with a set of privacy. It comes with some tools that allows you to do this type of thing. For example, request to join that the admin of a group has to approve. So if a student applies to join a referee group, they can't, because the referee won't allow them. So just, I think there's many ways to do this thing. So the simplest one would be just using the groups, which
I would use the, like once the Folksonomy is available, and I would use that for every group can have use unique tags. And also once we have a request to follow feature that allows admins of every group, whether they're referees or art teachers or anything, to basically monitor. People have to send a follow request and join in. So those would be for private groups. And I think those two should take care of a lot of the problems right there. And it's a very sort of simple and organic solution. Do you think that will work?
Yeah, this is interesting. And this is, I was thinking, one more example could be if you had the university, then this could also be relevant, couldn't it?
What do you mean?
Because then you have different departments, but within one department you have many study groups.
Okay. In that case, you can create one group for the department, and also you can create groups for every study group, and somehow create an association amongst them. And that's where we have to build our tagging and improve it. Right now we have some theories, we have to build them. For example, whether you add a knowledge node tag to a group, or whether you tag a group by other actors, the same way you can tag a picture, let's say, in Facebook, but imagine you create a group and also tag that group by other groups or other actors, and that way you sort of create a relationship. Or you have to actually build a feature that you can create an association between department group and also the study groups. So that's something we need to experiment. But it's a very good challenge and case scenario that you brought to us. So
I have just one small add-on question to this, what you mentioned now, and then I'm very, very, very happy.
Yeah.
And that is... this is a big, big question for me. And this is, when you hear what I'm talking about now, and compare that with the scenario I was talking about earlier, to think about maybe two networks and try to do something to make them work together. Is this way, what we are talking about now, is this the way to do it?
That is certainly one approach. Let's say if you want to build one social network only for the school groups and one for the, let's say, art and music groups and one for... and what's on your mind, Ash? Do you have anything to add? Like, let's say if we want to maintain multiple social networks. But that means the students should have accounts on all of them, right? Or not?
I actually thought about something right now that we already have talked about this, and it's not it's sort of like what we did at Anita Police, except it's not something that comes out of the box yet. For example, the way Anita Police, we have people who purchase subscription, and those people who purchase a subscription have access to certain groups. Well, this is essentially what you're asking, is that some people have some privilege to do things that are different than others. The people who purchase subscription, they actually have a role that becomes a subscriber. And based on their roles, they have access to certain things. And that's what we're doing on Anita Police. One solution would be that, is that we actually have roles, like, and then the group decides what roles can access them. That's actually, like right now, if somebody hasn't, let's say, purchased a subscription, they can access some of the groups.
Another thing to be... Okay, go on. Because I'm just thinking about a case scenario.
We already talked about this. Yeah. I don't know, Rustin, if you remember, we already talked about this, that actually what the subscription does is basically creates packages, which you think about them as roles.
Yes.
If basically, a package determines what a person, depending on logic, can do or cannot do.
Yeah, that is one approach that you sort of...
And subscription really... what this is basically called the role-based access.
Yeah.
Basically, depending on the role that you have, let's say somebody like you you have the role of a subscriber, you have certain access, which is a very generic approach when it comes to things like that.
Another thing I was thinking, let's say we have one group, which is a department, and it's associated with a collection of study groups. And we can write a app or extension for the for a group that, for example, when I follow the department group, I also automatically follow all the associated study groups.
Yeah.
So that would be another way that can be done. And then, but again, if I'm a student, I probably don't belong to all the study groups. I just follow the department and then my own study group. So you probably don't need to automate that. So to build this, I don't think you need to put them on different networks. I would keep everything in one network, but instead build a proper folksonomy or model that every group is tagged, and then add, like every group can be private and request to follow has to be sent. We also like to see ways to create associations across groups if the folksonomy is not enough. But your case scenario is a very good one. So next time when we are planning the folksonomy, we're going to also test it with your case scenario because
I would be very happy. I thank you very much for this.
You can hear I have
moved from my former thinking, and what you are saying there is just confirming my thought that probably the way to go is to think one network, several communities in one network.
Yes,
I think that's a good approach because you still want people to connect with each other, and that's actually because groups are good that people get things done in it, but outside of them, people still want to connect and talk and do things. And I think they should be on one community. I think there are ways to get around what your issues you're having, and there's many ways to do that, but the basic one would be groups. And what you mentioned here is not think about that specific thing all the time. There is cases like that, because on Anaita Police, we do this sort of the same thing. I mean, you're seeing it. We have certain groups for certain, let's say, people who, let's say, purchase a subscription, but at the other time, we have public groups. So, yes, it's a good case scenario, as Rustin put it.
Well, I will start. I will continue as soon as we have finished here.
It's a good case scenario because we are keep reminding people. That's like one of the challenges that people need to learn to in terms of there is no hierarchy or sub or dom relationships amongst the actors, let's say, in a social network. There are only associations. And now we need to build a system that can work with associations. The example that you mentioned, but I think because in a network, we have people. People are there. But then you look at a department or study groups, they're just contexts. A department is a context or that's different people joining. These people could be professors or students or researchers. And then study groups, there are contexts. And there can be relationship amongst these contexts. And so a group is a new context. It's basically an actor that represents a collection of people. And actually, two days ago, Ash and I were talking about making even the groups more generic, letting the groups to even follow other actors. You can follow a group, but the group can also follow back. Just to see whether we can make design more generic and more flexible for more case scenarios. I noticed Google Plus already does that. Even Facebook does that. On a page, you can follow other pages. And when you switch your the viewer from the person to the group identity, it actually, on the dashboard, you see all the updates coming from other groups you're following. We'd like to experiment that. But yeah, your case scenario is a very good one. Thank you. We can, so when we are after 1.7, once we start working on node association and folksonomy, we can test our design with your case scenario.
Thank you very much. The link I was trying to find to you, I can just tell you where it is. It is in the top in project groups, and you will find it was from Ken Richards. He was the one with the veteran. And you can see because he also has some interesting question on this.
Yes, I'm familiar with Ken's project. We actually had a conversation with him the other day, and his project is very interesting too. So now we have two case scenarios to test our design with, which is great.
Yeah.
what we need.
Thank you very much indeed. That was very interesting. Thank you.
Oh, thank you, Ben. Okay, I guess I'm going to go through some questions with Ash. These are frequently asked questions that are coming or they're asked in the community, in the Anaita tribes. And Ben, you're more than welcome to stick around and contribute. So should I start with that? The first question is that everyone asked, is there a demo for Anahita? I mean, these are people coming in and asking, okay, where is the demo? And we don't have a demo. We give a free account on Anahita Police. And people can experience how we use Anahita on a day-to-day fashion, how we use the software to run our day-to-day operation. Because social networking is a multi-user experience. if you want to really see the capabilities of a social network, you have to be there with other people interacting. And I understand there are other projects that are providing a demo. There are often projects that put so much emphasis on their feature list rather than the solution. So you join in, you're the only one on a seemingly network, and there is lots of features to play with. The focus of Anahita is to be an infrastructure solution, not a feature product. So that's why we don't have a demo. Instead, we give you a free account so you can join in and actually experience Anahita on a real-life environment. Ravi, welcome in. And and I can hear some noise. So I guess I just answered the first question, which is a frequently asked question, whether there is a demo for Anahita. No, you get a free account. And also, all the applications that we use are installed on the people profile, so you can enable them and play around. That is better than any demo. Okay, the second question is that, is there a project roadmap? Ash, did you want to answer this one?
I think you should answer it.
I should answer. Okay. Well, we don't have a project roadmap. We don't do that because we believe a project roadmap is essentially a list of false promises. You add a list of things that you think you're going to be developing. Yes, it gives a warm and fuzzy feeling to all the members that, ooh, look at all those features we're going to get. But as the project goes through, so many things changes, and you almost never follow the project roadmap. So there's no point in really giving out a list of false promises. The way it works in Anahita project is that we have a vision. We set a vision, but we always plan the next 2 or 3 weeks because that's what we know. We look at the state of the code today, and then we plan the next 2-3 weeks of what we want to work on. And then we populate the to-do lists and assign priorities to them and then start accomplishing all the to-dos. And the to-do items that we list, they don't have a sequence or order. We just assign them most important, or, you know, because that's enough. We decide the order at the moment that we just finished the to-do. We look at the state of the code. We get to pick and choose what's next we're going to work on. We are staying away from a very structured and over-planned approach because that just doesn't work in the agile development environment. So that goes with the project roadmap. I believe there are some articles from 37 Signals, also from 2007, that says talks about why roadmaps are not necessary. But roadmaps are really popular in open source projects because it gives a warm and fuzzy to the feeling to the community, and also it's usually a form of promise from the developers to the community that they're going to deliver projects. We don't do the roadmaps because the plan can change, and we don't want to give you false promises.
I mean, there have been cases that me and you even talked about features, and weeks later we just realized about that doesn't even make sense.
Yes.
That happens all the time.
Yeah.
But as you said, the whole idea is that we know where we're going, the vision, what the vision is, how the roadmap, how it's implemented is basically right on the spot, and then we decide that. Of course, the more stable the project gets, the more clear it becomes. That's just the nature of it being more mature. But in general, setting up a detailed roadmap or even any kind of roadmap that this is going to come, I don't think there's any point because we might not do that. The idea is that we should be able to do the right thing, not because we promised something and we have to deliver.
I would say the only promise we give is for the items that are already delivered. That's the safest way. But other than that, we want to be able to experiment, go through many iterations, and add, remove things, or even later decide that this option that we picked was not a good idea to begin with. And the roadmap goes against that concept. All right. The third question. What sort of skills do I need in order to set up and customize Anahita? And I'm going to emphasize this is not about app development. This is only for people who want to set up and customize Anahita. Ash?
What, is it about a template or did you want
to... Yeah, this is really for people who want to start a social network using the generic features and generic apps that we distribute.
Well, basically, right now, you can get a copy of Anahita, install it. It's not that difficult. It takes the same skills to install a WordPress blog. And after that, once you install the Anahita, we have our own code distribution channel called Anahita Bazaar. That once Anahita is installed, you can just go to the Bazaar and install all the apps. And that pretty much gets you started. There's some configuration that you may need to do in order to make an ATO, like, for example, for notification mails to be sent out. You have to set up, but those are the ones that we can help you with, help people with. And as for the customizing, I don't know if it's related to customizing template or not.
It is, yeah.
Well, I guess that's the part you probably know better.
Here's the case. If you want to set up or customize an ATO, if you have experience with basic PHP, HTML, and CSS and JavaScript programming, you have a very good foundation to get started. If you're familiar with other technologies such as WordPress, Drupal, or Joomla, or you work with other frameworks, you have a very good foundation to get started. Anahita's templating system is perhaps one of the most flexible available today in the market. You can overwrite any layout, and all the UI, all the user interface libraries are overwritable, or the layouts are overwritable. And also, we are using Bootstrap 2.0 technology as well as less CSS technology, which allows you to really customize the look and feel in a much easier fashion than traditional CSS coding. So if you have basic web design and development skills, you have very good foundations to get started with setting up and customizing Anahita. However, if you want to do Anahita application development, and that's the next question that people ask, what skills do I need in order to develop Anahita applications and extensions? That goes into the knowledge of software development. So Ash can help you on that.
Yeah, well, it takes a spectrum of, I don't think there's any specific skills, but the biggest skills that you have to have, I think, to do software development is having patience and ability to learning to read code, because all the other skills are learnable. Yes, we do use some concept in software development, such as different design patterns like model view, controller, domain-driven design, object-oriented programming. But these are basics right now when you want to build any app. I can't imagine if you want to start building any app in any of the platforms out there, you can't do it without those knowledge. So that's the minimum requirement for pretty much everything. But what you really need is ability to read code and ability to have the patience to do that, because there's so many concepts that we use and we didn't learn these, we just had to go ahead and find it. People often ask about examples. Well, we have examples. We have about 8 apps that are using the same building blocks as Anahita offers, and they're the perfect examples. So we will over time provide some, like I understand there's some API reference of, that we need to provide, and that's what we're planning to do, to actually create the API reference for people to be able to find the code or part in line that they're trying to find the class or library that they're trying to find, like, faster. But other than that, I think reading code is the best skill to have when you start building apps, because the examples are out there and you can actually find what you're looking for.
That sounds good. I'm going to add to what you just said, Ash, that the foundations you need to get inside this realm of software development, first is the programming and object-oriented programming knowledge. So if you have programmed in JavaScript, PHP, or Java, or Ruby on Rails in the past, you have a very good foundation. And the next is knowledge of development using frameworks. There are so many frameworks available out there that most commonly they follow MVC or Model View Controller patterns, Ruby on Rails, Cake PHP, or if you're developing in iPhone applications, they all follow variations of MVC or Nuku framework. Anahita also provides its own MVC. So it's nothing out of the ordinary, and Anahita uses the same design patterns that are standard in the software development world. So you have your MVCs, you have behaviors, you have mixins, and singletons, and it follows the domain-driven design. It uses those design patterns to build its node graph story architecture. And that's the part that is unique to Anahita. I think until today, Anahita is still the only open source technology in the social networking era that follows the correct node graph story architecture. And a lot of people know programming, but because they don't have a knowledge of design patterns, they get confused. They say that, I'm pretty good in PHP programming or Java, but I don't understand things when I look at Anahita. I don't understand the relationships. And when you look further, you realize that they have a weakness in the area of understanding software design patterns. To give you an analogy, knowing programming language is like speaking a language, like knowing to read and write English or French or German. Knowing how to develop a software is like being able to write a novel or comedy or a drama. So you have to understand how to use the language and create different workflows or structures or beginnings or endings and patterns. So that's where software development comes in. And also the knowledge of reading code, it's very important. And it takes time to develop that skill that you read code and you can quickly recognize those design patterns by looking at the file structure and also the codes. And those are skills that if you have developed in using frameworks in the past, you have developed them. If you're doing Ruby on Rails or CakePHP or CodeIgnite or any of the frameworks out there, you are already familiar with a lot of the common design patterns. And after a while working with Anita, you can quickly pick those up as well. I would like to go to the next question that a lot of developers ask, and that's, is there documentation available for Anahita 1.6 or in general for Anahita?
As for documentation, I guess we need to be a little more specific what sort of documentation we're thinking of. Basically, I think we will have an API reference. I think that's the basics that every open source project provides. The reason we haven't provided that was because our API wasn't stable. But after the release, this release, it will be for the most part. And we sort of like have automated the system that we can every time, like what I have in mind is that ability to basically every time we do make a commit to a repository, actually regenerate the API to make sure that the API reference is always up to date. That's one of the things we're planning to do. Other than that, we have provided some documentation about how to the overall overview of Anahita, what is actors, what is medium. Could provide some sort of overview, like in terms of graphics, UML diagram. I'm not really big fan of UML diagrams, but more of like a general view of how Anahita interacts. I think that's actually, when you go to other projects like Ruby on Rails and other ones, that's pretty much when it comes to documentation. And after that, it's the over time with people's questions. It provides a repository of knowledge for people to find what they're looking for. That's what I'm thinking that we will have for Anahita.
Just to add to on top of that, for documentation, until now, we relied on the community because the Anahita code has been changing quite fast, so there was no point in documenting it. I mean, it was not really possible to document the code. But instead, we rely on people who were setting up their systems or developing apps, and they would ask us questions. And based on the first come, first serve, and any question that would come up, it would have inspired writing a tutorial or code example. And over time, we have developed a collection of applications. Every one represents a whole category of applications, and they can be used as blueprints that you guys can use as code examples. And for the Anahita 1.7, our next, which is going to be a stable release, yes, we will have documentation. As Ash explained, we're going to provide documentation and some examples. And anytime we see a frequently asked question or tutorial that people ask, we would like to put it out as one comprehensive documentation for developers to get started. We would like to emphasize that documentation is great. It's necessary. It doesn't replace code reading. You still have to really work on your code reading skills because that is still the best way for you to understand the relationships and the detail and the syntax of the code. And sometimes it takes days for us to read code, even each other's code when Ash and I work. Ash is a lot better than I am, but for me, it takes sometimes days to read and understand Ash's code, and then we transfer that knowledge to the community. So give yourself some time. You don't have to move with the same pace as we do. And yes, as I said about UML diagrams, UML concepts were great. I mean, it's a promise that it's supposed to be helpful. They're great, especially if you're at school handing in assignments or if you're working in a more rigid corporate structure that everything has to be over-planned, over-documented. But in an agile development environment, UMLs are not as popular because creating detailed UMLs and maintaining them takes a lot of time. It's a very tedious process. and they don't help as much. I mean, once you become a code reader, and also because we use a lot of convention over configuration and design patterns that are known, UMLs really don't serve a purpose there. If you do UML diagrams for a lot of the apps developed using different frameworks, they're all going to end up looking very similar because they all use the same patterns. For someone who just came out of school or a traditional work environment and they really believe in those things, sorry, this is an agile development environment and things work a little more fluid. So our documentation may not include extensive UML diagrams, but we're going to provide code documentations using PHP docs. We're going to publish tutorials or the frequently asked questions or case scenarios that people ask. And also the applications we develop are there as examples. So once you understand, recognize, and learn the design patterns, you can look at the applications and start prototyping and experimenting. Another point I would like to mention, there is a difference between open source projects and a proprietary world project when it gets to documentation. When you are in a proprietary world, they do not usually release a technology until documentation is ready. So they wait until documentation is done or it's at an acceptable level, and then they release it with the framework to the community of developers. And that's why developers are under the impression that, wow, I got a technology and documentation with it. How great. Which is wonderful. In an open source project, especially in Anahitapolis, that from the beginning, even when before code is written and it's at the ideal level, people get to see what's going on. And as we develop the code and go through many iterations and many experiments, people get to see the code develop and until its stable release is available. But during this process, we don't build documentation. Documentation is written mainly after the framework is stable, because then you want to write about it. So that means that you have to wait a bit longer to get the documentation. Because you get the framework first, you had it from the beginning that it was being developed, and documentation comes after. People get the wrong impression that I got a technology that didn't come with documentation, which is not true. Just because they were in touch with the project from the beginning, and they got the code first and documentation later. And that's just the nature of open source project. Yes, you have freedom, information is available and open and transparent, and that also means that you see the process as it is. The technology comes first and the documentation later. So if you really need documentation to learn the code, and code reading alone is not enough for you to learn the technology, you're going to have to wait a bit longer. So I think I just finished my long conversation about the documentation, but it was a topic very much discussed in the community, and people ask. We really wanted to spend some time describing those. And Ravi, you joined in right now. You finally made it. How are you today?
Yeah, I'm good. I'm doing good. Actually, I miscalculated the time.
Did you?
I was a bit late then.
Okay. Did you have a question to ask us?
Yeah, this is regarding groups and dividing into subgroups and stuff. So I'll just explain you a scenario, and just I'll let you know your views on that. Let's take a college scenario where we have English, where we have subjects called first year English, or second year English, third year English, or something like that. So if someone wants to, we can create groups like first year English, second year English, and third year English. And each one, everyone interested can subscribe to that group. But if someone wants to subscribe to English in general, he has to subscribe to all the three groups.
Mm-hmm.
So here is my issue. Can't we have English as a group and English 1, English 2, English 3 as subgroups? So that if someone wants to subscribe to all the groups, maybe I'm just talking in terms of Twitter lists, something in that line.
No, I think actually that's what Beth was talking about earlier too. But I have a question for you, because I think there's, I want to understand something. Do these groups, you're not just using it because you want to categorize, they actually have legitimate content. Let's say you have an English group that actually has content pushing out to the subscribers, correct? Or are these content any different than the subgroup, or are they the same content?
It's the same content. The same content, and it can, I mean, the same continent, it can be more.
What, they're not...
No, no, it would be a combined content from group English year 1, English year 2, English year 3.
So it's a combination of all of them then?
Yeah, the whole as a package, as a list maybe.
Okay, so that's the thing. Because when you say subscribe, because what you're describing is in words is correct. You're saying you have English 1, English 2, English 3. I want to be able to follow all of them. But understand something. A group is really not just... Yes, there is a part that the group creates a categorization, but a group is really, if you think about it, what's important in the group is the content. Every group is individualistic, like in terms of content, it's unique than the next group. What you're asking is, would it be possible to be able to allow a person to follow, let's say, an entity that allows them to follow all the other entities related to that? Because you would think that English group would contain all the content of all of its subgroup, but it might not, because if it's a group, it has its own life. It has its own content that may or may not relate to the other one, because people go to this group, create content. So if I follow English group, that doesn't... If the content are generated under the English group, then that means the content belongs to the English group, not to the English 1 or English 2 or English 3. Let's say if you have a discussion board in the English group itself, it has its own life, it has its own unique content.
But we'll be missing on other information.
Okay, go on, Ravi.
Yeah, but we'll be missing other information from other groups, like English 1, English 2, English 3. There would be the same thing, right? They are related. The groups can, you can have some kind of relation, like we have for posts, related posts. So these are related groups, so... Maybe we can have something like that.
Well, there's a concept that we have that you can create content in each group and share it with the other content. That means, let's say, if you create a content in the English group, then you can say this content also belongs to all the other groups. They're not necessarily subgroups, but they're, let's say you have a content in the English, and then you can say this content also belongs to English 1 and English 2 and English 3. That makes sense. For example, right now we have Anaita groups. I should be able to create a documentation under one group and share it in the other group as well. That means if people go to the other group, they can see the same content.
So someone can post for a discussion topic in the same discussion topic in two or more groups.
Oh, I just want to hop in. My first pet peeve issue that I have, there is no such a thing as subgroups. There is no sub or dom relationships amongst the actors in a social network, because hierarchies in social network do not exist. There are only associations or relationships. So you can say there is a you can say there are English 1, 2, or 3, like 101, 102, 103 groups. And you don't need to have sub and dom relationship. If you follow all three groups, then all the content naturally gets aggregated in your dashboard. So you get content coming from all of them. So you don't need to have a generic group and a more specific groups. And the other aspect is that you can tag the content, and then you can create filters by the tag content. There will also be ability to share. So when I create a content, let's say in one English group, I should be able to also share it with other English group if I have the permission to do so. If not, because in that case, I can just tag it. So people who want to obtain information coming from all the English groups, they just create a filter for the tag and they get only those stories that are coming in. Or they sort of click on the tag and get all the pages and topics that are related to the English, coming from any group, doesn't matter. And the other question would be following groups that are all English related. There is one concept that Google Plus is using and I'm very interested in to build an Anaita version. People are sharing circles. I can put together a collection of people in my social graph that are, let's say, all photographers, and offer that to you as a package, share it with other people, and say, when you follow that, you suddenly 100 photographers that I recommended gets added to your social graph. So we can create a concept like that on Anaita. For example, we can create ability to create a collection of English groups and then share it with everyone. So people just follow that.
Yeah.
And what it does, it automatically follows all the English groups. And that would solve the problem. what do you think?
Actually, that would be a nice thing. When I was even asking that, I had this Twitter list in mind. It's actually a similar thing. They create people. You must be aware of that, right?
Yeah. That's sort of similar concept. That you basically build collections of actors and you share it with other people to follow. It's not content curation, but it's more like an actor curation. So those are things we like to experiment with after 1.7 release. Once we start building Node Association of Oxonomy, to also work on those areas.
I think in your case right now, the sharing is like, well, one of the things that we're looking to actually have done is the sharing, because I should be able to create the content on my own profile. I mean, think about it this way. And give it to different groups. That means the content also, other groups have access to the same group. That means I don't have to have a redundant content. Mm-hmm. This is one of the issues we're dealing with in Anaita. For example, we have documentation that belongs to multiple groups. We don't know that. Let's say I build how to build a photo app. That goes both in Anaita and the photo group. In your case, by your definition, the photo group would have been a subgroup of Anaita, which is not the case, though, because this is more a generic approach to build any kind of relationship. Today might be English 1 or 2, next day will be some other thing. You don't want to lock yourself in some kind of a structure.
You will be locking yourself.
So we have several solutions to this problem. I don't know exactly which one would definitely solve that, but I think sharing is one of the ones we have focused on right now, very soon, to have the tagging and sharing, that I should be able to basically attach the content that I just created to other actor notes or other notes. We're looking forward to that one, though.
Okay. Thank you very much for the case scenario, because right now we have 3 case scenarios to go through. One is Ken, one that Bent provided, and one that you. When, after 1.7 release, when we start working on node associations and Foxonomy and all of those, we can test our scenarios, we can test our design against your scenarios and see if it holds up. So thank you for that. The good conversations today. So we are 1 hour right now, although we had some wasted time, but we can probably spend 5-10 minutes more if you guys have anything else to talk about. Do you have any topic that you would like to share?
No, actually I was curious that without UML, how do you manage your development without UML?
Without UML, you don't need UML to manage development. Like, if anyone told you need UML, they're not right.
What I'm actually asking is, what's your procedure? I'm interested in what kind of procedures you follow.
Okay, Ash, you go on.
You know, actually, the thing is, I really focus on what I'm trying to do, and I change the code to achieve that.
So you basically write it down?
I think about it all the time. I code it. The thing is, it's really important to, like my end result, it's really important to focus on that part and what I'm trying to do, and I use the skills that I learned to do that, and it's only do I write it down. Sometimes I doodle something on the paper, I don't have to create that. It's not something that's usable for other people, basically. It's something that I might do. And the thing is, the more you do this, over time, you gain some kind of a skills. I'll tell you something else. I look at other people's code, how they do their things, and I get inspiration. For example, I look at Johan Jansson, the Nuku core developer. He has mad skills when it comes to it. And I learned from him by reading his code. He might not necessarily solve my problem, but he doing the same similar thing in other cases. And I follow his pattern, and I repeat that, and I learn it by this way. So I don't know if there's a saying or not, but by copying, you actually start learning. So you don't have to actually understand it in the beginning, but you start copying, but over time it starts to make sense. That's why we tell people that if you want to build the app, take one of our existing app and start changing that. Copy it. It's okay. You're not a copycat by doing it, but that's how you learn, by copying at first.
That's one thing. I think one reason that schools are incapable of creating good programmers these days is because copying other people's code is considered cheating. But in the open source world, You can read other people's code, you can modify it, you can change it, you can redistribute it, and it's perfectly okay as long as you give credit to the original creator. So, and that's the beauty of open source. And a lot of the generic applications that we provide with Anahita, they cover most of the case scenarios. So you can use that as your initial pattern, as your initial design, and you can start changing to move away. And that's when you are building a new application. If you want to customize an existing app, you shouldn't change the code. There are better ways to overwrite the behavior. And that's a different context. But yes, at school they taught us, and I went through the computer science program. Ashdale, Johan Janssens has a master's degree, but right now we've broken so many and unlearned so many of the stuff they taught us at school. One of them was writing pseudocode and then doing UML and doing some kind of overplanning, and then and writing a roadmap. And then you start writing software. And then when you develop the software, none of it actually goes as planned and according to UML or pseudocode. So you end up changing your code while at the same time you're changing your documentation, your UML, and everything. It becomes a mess. At the end, when your software is finished, then you write some documentation and everything nice and squeaky, and then you go and get a good mark, hopefully. But in real life that you solve your problems, UML is probably the least efficient way. It's a great visual tool to quickly communicate some concepts, but you don't need UML to start developing software. And one of the things that they do in the agile development world is that we use a lot of conventions over configuration. We use a lot of design patterns. And once you know those design patterns, you don't need any visual representation because you already know what they are. And to understand the detail and the syntax, you must read the code. UML is not going to give you that. There is a book from Paul Graham that I recommend you to read. It's called Hackers and Painters. He's also got all these essays available online for free. So if you just Google it. And he describes that hackers, don't follow what the school told them with the UML and pseudocode approach. When hackers write code, it's not from top down. When hackers write code, it's more like painting or doing a sculpture. They first doing some doodle on the canvas, and they put the elements together, then they beat them to shape and refine it over so many iterations until they get the desirable results. And that approach is very experimental, very evolutionary, and it's not something you can plan ahead of time. And it's a practice very common in agile development world. 37 Signals, the guys who did the Ruby on Rails, they practice it a lot. The guys who do Nuku framework, they're doing it. In Anahita, we do it. That's why we don't have a roadmap. we only plan what we're going to do for the next 2-3 weeks, and then we have a vision. So at every point in time, we look at the vision and decide what we're going to build for the next 2-3 weeks. And we populate the to-do lists. And the to-do list is our short-term roadmap, in a way you can look at it. And we don't do UML, unless if it's maybe one or two examples for certain case scenarios, if we realize UML does a good job of representing it. But right now, if you go around to so many projects, most documentation is provided through code examples, through PHP doc, and describing what design patterns are used. Did I answer your question? Cool. This was actually a recent hot topic in the community because it's a lot easier to complain than to actually sit down and put the effort to learn code. That's the difference between hackers and non-hackers.
I was actually concerned if there's mad logic. So we can build it, but at some point later in the time, we need some kind of graphical representation to understand it.
I sort of understand. There's a concept you write about I don't think that this necessarily call that UML in the sense that using computations. I think putting some kind of overview of what it like a general overview of what it is or how the interaction goes. For example, I wrote this tutorial. I don't know if anybody has I'm sure people have read it, about the basic, what happens when a request comes to Anaita, how does it work from then on? And yes, there's so many things happening, especially in Anaita. Like, yes, it would have been easier just to show it on a picture. Like, this is where the request comes, this is where it goes, and this is what happens. And I had to write all these articles. And that's one of the things that I got from one of the things that people mentioned about graphical representation is that, yes, for some cases, to show overall overview of the interaction, that does help. And I agree with that. And it's actually easier to do that than write about it because it sort of gives the people a visual. But that's not UML in the sense that I want to see the class thing or I want to see the exact operation have it. Because there is, it's not possible because, you know, the code is there. When you get the whole picture, it's easier to read the code to find all the little things because you can't document those things and you shouldn't.
Even when I was talking about UML, I was more talking about graphical representation than UML.
Yeah, that I agree. Actually, I've sort of been thinking about that because it's actually easier for me, especially to do those in a way, because that's how I actually understand it too. Something that basically tells me, okay, picture number 1, 2, 3, and 4 happens when a request comes in. That's good enough that I get that. For this, something simple like that, I had to write this lots of line of, I had to write I don't know, 400.
Those are valid cases that UML actually is good.
It's easy to watch a movie than read a novel, right?
Yeah.
Of course, yeah.
It's like watching animation, yeah.
Yeah, I agree with those. And it just sort of like hit me that, oh, that's actually a lot easier and it's more understanding. And I've been thinking about that. And yes, we think that's good.
Yeah, I just shared the link to the Hackers and Painters essay from Paul Graham. And you can go to paulgraham.com/hp.html for those who are listening to this podcast. It's a really good essay to read. So, yes, UML, there are some cases a visual representation works really well, especially if you're looking at a case scenario or, you know, like what happens in 3 or 5 stages. But other than that, if you want to describe the entire architecture of a software app in UML, well, first of all of them are going to look the same, especially because of so many MVC apps these days. And UML doesn't give you a lot of the detailed syntax you need to know. You still have to read the code, and there's no magic pill or shortcuts to avoid that. All right. I think we have 1 hour and 10 minutes, so after I edit the show, there's going to be a nice 1 hour show for this week. And I would like to thank you guys, Bent and Ravi, for attending. Pleasure having you guys. You guys brought in very good case scenarios and questions. And thank you very much.
Thank you very much. It has been a pleasure. Thank you.
Yeah, and...
Thank you, Rustin, and thank you, Ash.
Have a wonderful weekend, you guys.